Let's kick off another week of our 4.5-year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. We're going to do that by opening up the Word of God to Isaiah chapter number 13. Isaiah, you remember, is a prophet of the 8th century BC, late 8th century and early 7th century BC. And he, most recently in our stories, was key in helping Hezekiah understand that first, he was going to die, but then that God was going to give him an additional 15 years of life. And Hezekiah was understandably quite thankful for that extra 15 years, but he made a grave error. When he received a visitor, or visitors, from the king of Babylon, which at that time was a small city-state that was trying to resist the Assyrians, just like Hezekiah was doing. When he received visitors from the Babylonians, he showed them everything in the Judean kingdom, including all the wealth that was in storage at the palace and at the temple. And God sent Isaiah to chew Hezekiah out for allowing that to happen, and told him, prophesied to him, that because of that, the Babylonians would know many years into the future that they could plunder the kingdom of Judah of all that wealth, and they would do so. That would all happen during the final years of the city of Jerusalem and the Babylonian exile that will begin at that same time. Well, Hezekiah was slightly, I think, taken aback by that, and maybe had a little bit of grief over having done what he did. But the frustrating thing that we closed on last time was that he said, well, at least that's not going to happen in my days. And that's just not the right way to think about the eventual judgment of God, is that just because it's not happening in our time doesn't make it okay. We need to be thinking about those that come after us and do what we can to help them out. Well, Isaiah, because he now is aware of what the Babylonians will do eventually against Judah, is also given a vision from God about what is going to happen to Babylon after they have been used by God as a tool for judgment. And this is one of the things that many of the more liberal critics make their complaints that the book of Isaiah was not written during the 8th century BC because it knew too much about the future history of Judea and Babylon and the Medes and the Persians and things like that. And of course, those of us that are much more conservative in our approach to Scripture go, well, of course he knew a lot more than he should have because God was providing the information and God knows everything from beginning to end. So with that approach, we are going to see what it was that God revealed to the prophet Isaiah in the 8th century BC about things that would happen in the 600s and 500s and even afterwards BC. And to some extent, I believe there is encoded here references to things that are still future to us, because the day of the Lord in Old Testament parlance is sometimes foreshadowing the second coming of Jesus and the things that happened immediately before that. Okay, with that background, let's read in Isaiah chapter 13. The oracle, which of course is just the literal word is burden, and so it's the idea of something carried. So this is the information given to Isaiah by God to carry to the people. The oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos saw. Verse 2. On a bare hill, raise a signal. Cry aloud to them. Wave the hand for them to enter the gates of the nobles. So there is a picture here that he sees of people being gathered against Babylon. Verse 3, I myself have commanded my consecrated ones and have summoned my mighty men to execute my anger, my proudly exulting ones. So God is going to orchestrate the eventual punishment of the Babylonian Empire. The sound of a tumult is on the mountains as a great multitude. The sound of an uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathering together. He who is over the armies is mustering a host for battle. So God is picturing himself as the one that will bring a close to Babylonian history by bringing foreign nationals against it. They came or come from a distant land, from the end of the heavens. He who is, and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. Wail, for the day of he who is near. As destruction from the Almighty, it will come. So when Isaiah pictures the destruction of the Babylonian Empire by the Medes and the Persians, he says that the people in Babylon will be wailing because God's judgment day has come upon them. But again, there are hints, almost always when this idea of the day of the Lord is mentioned, hints about when Jesus comes back at the end of the 3.5 years described in the book of Revelation, and he brings the ultimate judgment against the final world ruler and establishes his own eternal kingdom. Verse 7, therefore all hands will be feeble, and every human heart will melt. They will be dismayed. Pangs and agony will seize them. They will be in anguish like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at one another. Their faces will be aflame. So everybody's going to be really messed up when the judgment of God comes, whenever that is. Past, present, future. People coming under that judgment are made exceptionally uncomfortable. Verse number 9, behold, the day of he who is comes, cruel with wrath and fierce anger, to make a land a desolation and to destroy its sinners in it. Then we have some poetic language when it is applied to the time period of Babylon being taken over by the Medes and the Persians and their empire basically just disappearing from the face of the earth. But I believe that what's poetic here becomes less poetic in connection with the book of Revelation. Verse 10, For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. And we know that later books in the Old Testament period, Jesus in his Olivet Discourse, and then, of course, the book of Revelation itself, describe how when the sixth seal is broken and the final 3.5 years before Jesus returns kicks off, it will be accompanied by great signs in the heavens. The sun will go dark, the moon will go blood red, and the stars will be falling from the sky. And stars, a poetic reference to angelic beings. And we know that in the book of Revelation chapter 12, Satan and his angels will be kicked out of their supernatural element into the physical world. and they will be looking like stars falling from the sky. And so all of this is poetic for Babylon, but much more literal in the book of Revelation when they take place. Verse 11, I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pomp of the arrogant and lay low the pompous pride of the ruthless. I will make people more rare than fine gold and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Depopulation is going to be a significant part of the waning of the Babylonian Empire. But it will also be a significant part of the Book of Revelation story in relationship to the final 3.5 years. By the time everything is said and done, a half of the world's population in the Book of Revelation seems to be gone. Verse number 13, therefore, I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken out of its place as the wrath of he who is the Lord of hosts, so he who is over the armies, in the day of his fierce anger, and like a hunted gazelle, or like sheep with none to gather them, each will turn to his own people, each will flee to his own land. When military routs occur, that's how it's kind of described. Everybody is running helter-skelter away, running for their own lands and for their own homes. And it's just like a herd of antelope or deer when they're startled by a hunter. They just scatter everywhere. Verse 15, whoever is found will be thrust through. Whoever is caught will fall by the sword. And that definitely is something that happens in military routes. And then the sad, sad civilian casualties. Their infants will be dashed in pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered and their wives ravished. And that, unfortunately, does happen way too often whenever a country is overwhelmed by an invading force, and especially after their own defensive military has broken down and run away. Verse 17. Now we get a clear picture as to the closest historical focus point to this prophecy. Verse 17, behold, I am stirring up the Medes against them. The Medes were the senior partner in the forming of the Medo-Persian Empire. And that was the empire that comes against the Babylon Empire and puts an end to it. So God uses them as a tool of judgment. Behold, I'm stirring up the Medes against them, who have no regard for silver, no delight in gold. In other words, they can't be bought off. Their bows will slaughter the young men. They will have no mercy on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes will not pity children. Just a repeat again of the horrors of warfare, especially when the country is being just overrun by an invading force. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the splendor and pomp of the Chaldeans, will be like Sodom and Gomorrah when God overthrew them. So they will come under God's judgment and cease to be of any more significance in history. It will never be inhabited or lived in for all generations. No Arab will pitch his tent there. No shepherds will make their flocks lie down there. Now we have a little focus right directly into the capital city of Babylon, which is still a ruin to this day. There's nobody really living at the ancient site of Babylon. They have dug it up, and people do visit there, but it has not been rebuilt. So as far as we can tell, this passage is still true as written here, that Babylon once destroyed, it loses its prominence and then it eventually disappears and gets buried under all the debris of time, that it's not going to be population center anymore. Now, others have said, and I acknowledge that this is very possible, that there will be something rebuilt on that site, that the final world ruler will set up his headquarters there on the site of ancient Babylon and will run his military operations in the Middle East from there, especially the military operations against Judea and against Jerusalem itself, where the two prophets will be located. And if that's the case, then we know once again that Babylon, mentioned in the book of Revelation, will be destroyed and will no longer be a place populated. And so all of this would still be true about that. So we don't know if it might be reoccupied for a brief period of time right before it's destroyed again, or if this is just the way it's always going to be. But the poetic description is this, verse 21, wild animals will lie there, their houses will be full of howling creatures. When you have a population abandon a city, wild creatures move in. There, ostriches will dwell. Don't know that this is actually the Hebrew word for ostriches. That's a theory. Other suggestions have been made, some sort of screeching owl. It does appear to be a bird creature, but it is a noisy, noisy, crying creature. I'm interested that the Greek word in the translation made in the 3rd century BC is where we get our word siren from, as in a really loud noise. And there, wild goats will dance. Hyenas will cry in its towers and jackals in the pleasant palaces. Its time is close at hand. Its days will not be prolonged. So basically, Babylon is going to cease being prominent. Its capital city will go into ruins, occupied by wild animals, and people are just not going to want to live there ever again. And that's still true to this date. Only people with an interest in archaeology go to the ancient site of Babylon City. Isaiah chapter 14. For he who is will have compassion on Jacob and will again choose Israel, and will set them in their own land, and sojourners will join them and will attach themselves to the house of Jacob. So a couple of prophecies here, one of them having to do with the returns under the Persians from ethnic Israeli groups in Mesopotamia and elsewhere back to the promised land. And they will be joined by hangers-on, people that also want to worship the God of Israel. But there's also the prophecy about the gospel and how the gospel goes out from Zion. And those of us that are Gentiles, we are the sojourners that attach ourselves to the house of Jacob through the name of Jesus Christ. And so all of that, too, can be part of this prophecy. Verse 2, the peoples will take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel will possess them in he who is his land as male and female slaves. And that literally did happen. There were non-Israeli slaves in Israel after this time. They will take captive those who were their captors and rule over those who oppressed them. So things will be flipped the other way around after the returns take place. When he who is has given you rest from your pain and turmoil and the hard service with which you were made to serve, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. So once the Babylonian exile is finished and Babylon itself is eclipsed and it's fallen onto the ash heap of history, then the Jewish people will have something to say about Babylon. How the oppressor has ceased. The insolent fury ceased. He who is has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers that struck the peoples in wrath with unceasing blows, that ruled the nations in anger with unrelenting persecution. The whole earth is at rest and quiet. They break forth into singing. So once Babylon was the terror, and what's really weird here is Isaiah is talking about something that's still future as if it's in the past. And that's just the way it works with prophecy. But once Babylon is gone, then there will be celebrations because they were so hard. The cypresses rejoice at you, the cedars of Lebanon saying, since you were laid low, no woodcutter comes up against us. You remember that several times, prophetically, the different nations of the Middle East have been described as trees in a forest, and how they were being chopped down in God's judgment by the Assyrians in that particular case. Well, here, Babylon had also been the wood chopper that had cut down some of the trees of the nations. And once Babylon is gone, the trees are safe. And so that's prophetically significant here. Sheol below is stirred up to meet you when you come. It rouses the shades to greet you, all who are leaders of the earth. It raises from their thrones all who are kings of the nation. All of them will answer and say to you, well, you too have become as weak as we. You have become like us. And so the poem or the poetry here pictures the fallen king or kings of Babylon being greeted in the place of the dead by those that they put there. And those people are saying, oh, so you're here now. Boy, you've sure come down a notch or two. Verse 11, your pomp is brought down to Sheol, the sound of harps, maggots are laid as a bed beneath you, and worms are your covers. So all of this is kind of a nya-nya-nya sort of taunt against the troublemaking Babylonian leadership once Babylon is gone. Now that's all still future to the time of Isaiah, but once it takes place, everybody will be glad that the king of Babylon is no more. At this point, though, there is another layer that is added to the prophecy, the poetry that is laid out here. It is agreed by many of us that do Bible studies that Isaiah, at God's command, looks beyond the human king of Babylon, who is a puppet, and sees the puppeteer behind the scenes. And that would be Satan himself, the one that causes trouble. God may use Assyria, God may use Babylon to accomplish his judgment, but Satan is the one that is carrying out a lot of this trouble. And he's doing it for his own purposes, just to stir the pot. And so let's look behind the scenes at the puppeteer, the spirit being that we call the devil or Satan. Verse 12, how you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of the dawn. The day star here is Halel. That's Hebrew. And it's a reference in Hebrew to the planet Venus, particularly when it's on the horizon in the morning just before the sun comes up. The Latin text at this point has the word Lucifer, which is literally the light bringer. And of course, that's softened later to Lucifer and another name for Satan. So how you've fallen from heaven, O Halel, O Lucifer, son of dawn, how you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I'll sit on the mount of the assembly in the far reaches of the north. So this is Satan at the time of his great rebellion, there at the time of the Garden of Eden, when he got himself so full of himself that he believed he should be in charge of everything, not God. And so he has his coup where he compromises some of the angels. And that's portrayed in the book of Revelation chapter 12 as the great red dragon in heaven that pulls down a third of the stars with his tail. And stars is a poetic reference often in the Old Testament to angelic beings. So we're assuming, we're guessing that Satan was able to compromise a significant minority of the original created angels whenever he had his coup. But it's all about him trying to be in charge. Verse 14, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I'll make myself like the Most High. So I want to be God. And of course, that's not going to happen. And eventually, he will be pulled completely down. As I mentioned in the introduction today, in the book of Revelation, Satan and his fallen angels will be booted out of the supernatural realm at the beginning of the final 3.5 years. Verse 15, but you are brought down to Sheol, to the far reaches of the pit, and those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you. Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a desert and overthrew its cities, and who not let his prisoners go home? And all the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb, but you are cast out away from your grave like a loathed branch, clothed with the slain, those pierced by the sword, those who go down to the stones, to the pit, like a dead body trampled underfoot. You will not be joined with them in burial because you have destroyed your land. You have slain your people. And so now we're kind of back to the physical king of Babylon who loses everything. But Satan himself will fall horribly when Jesus comes as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And Satan, whom everybody was really worried about and feared, will eventually become nothing. He will become the being of no consequence, consigned to the pits of hell for eternity.